It's time now to talk about sex. We need to cover the reproductive systems. And I say systems because there are two different reproductive systems, of course. It's the only one that's like that. There are 11 organ systems in the body. And the reproductive system is the only one for which there are different versions for male and female. We're going to cover them both in this chapter. But we'll start with the male because males are simpler anatomically and physiologically, at least as far as the reproductive system is concerned. And we're looking at a median section here, or at least most of it is median section. So it's cut right through the midline, right through the penis, as you see here. This shows you the major structures for the human male reproductive system. Now, there are what are called primary sex organs in any given species. For humans, the primary sex organs are not the penis and the vagina, as some of you might have suspected. The penis and the vagina are really just delivery devices. The primary sex organs are defined as primary sex organs because they are the things that produce the gametes. Gametes is a unisex term that means sex cells. So there are two different kinds of sex cells or gametes because there are two sexes. Well, the structures that produce gametes are called gonads. That's another unisex term. So there are male gonads and there are female gonads. And the gonads, whichever sex you're talking about, are the primary sex organs. So the primary sex organs in males are the testes. Now that is a plural term, the singular of which is testis. So there is no such word as testy, first of all. Testes is the plural of testis. This is a common for there to be an es ending for a word that a es for plural for a word that ends in is, like crisis, for instance. The plural of crisis is crises. So the plural of testis, which is one gonad in a male, is testes. Similarly, by the way, the plural for penis, which is singular, is penes, P-E-N-E-S. But the testes are the primary male sex organs. They are the male gonads. And so this isn't a complete median section, as I said before, that the we're looking at one testis on one side of the midline. So this is the right testis we're looking at right here. The left testis is hidden behind this in this view to the left. But the gonads in a male are different from a female's gonads, not only in what kind of gametes they make, but also in their position in the body. In a male, the gonads, once sexual maturity is hit, lie outside of the abdominal pelvic cavity. In a female, on the other hand, her gonads remain within the abdominal pelvic cavity throughout life. Male gonads, or testes, start out in the abdominal pelvic cavity, but as they develop, they descend, this is called descent of the testes, into this sac-like structure called the scrotum. So in most males, that happens without a problem, but there can be something that goes wrong, and the testes remain in the abdominal pelvic cavity. For most males, both testes will descend into the scrotum. So the testis itself, as you see on the label, is just this whitish kind of egg-shaped structure, but notice closely associated with it in pink here is a structure called the epididymis. That really means on the twins. Epi means on, di means two. So the didymis part of this means twins. That's referring to the twin testes, and the epididymites, which is the plural of epididymis, lie on each testis. It makes sense that they are associated with the testes because the testes produce sperm, but the in each epididymis, the sperm that are produced by the testis mature in the epididymis before eventually being released during ejaculation through this tube that we see right here, which is called either ductus deferens. That's the more modern term for it. It used to be called vas deferens. Either is acceptable, but ductus deferens is the preferred structure name now. By the way, vas means vessel, which is why vascular means of vessels, of blood vessels. Usually it's used that way. But this is also why we call the procedure that cuts this vessel a vasectomy. Ectomy means removal of. So ductus deferens being cut is a vasectomy, but you can also call it the vas deferens. One thing that we see from this, which might surprise you, and I'm sure would surprise most people who've never studied anatomy, is that during ejaculation, it's not a simple route of material from the scrotum to the penis. Notice that the how the plumbing works here. Semen is, first of all, a pretty complex mixture of things. It's more than just sperm, but semen includes sperm. The sperm, as I said, are created in the testes. They mature in the epididymis for a couple weeks, and then they're ready for ejaculation. During orgasm, the sperm get released from the epididymis by muscular contractions of the vas deferens. This sends it up in through the ductus deferens into the abdominal pelvic cavity. Notice that the ductus deferens loops around the ureter. The ureter is not part of the reproductive system anatomy. It's part of the urinary system anatomy. We'll look at that in a different chapter. But it loops around each ureter and then empties into a bag-like structure called an ampulla. It's really just the ending of the ductus deferens. And then that ductus deferens comes together with another tube coming from a separate structure called a seminal vesicle. So there are two seminal vesicles. We're looking at just the right side right now. Similarly, there are two ductus deferens, one for each of the two epididymides. So the sperm and water and a little bit of mucus get delivered through this ductus deferens into the ampulla, and then finally get mixed with the output of the seminal vesicle. Seminal vesicle produces another component, or several other components of the semen, and they get mixed together where these two tubes come together. But where these two tubes come together is really inside, in a sense, this structure right here, which is the prostate. The prostate is a word that means to stand before. Pro means before. State means stand. And it gets that name because it stands before, anatomically speaking, the penis itself. So a prostate is found in males, but not in females. It is about the size and shape of a walnut, and we're looking at it in cutaway view, but it surrounds this tubing. So where the seminal vesicle and the ampulla of the ductus deferens meet, that we're looking at here, we can only get a view of that because we've cut away the prostate. It would normally be surrounding it all. Well, the prostate is a gland, so it produces its own secretions that become part of the semen, and those get delivered through little ducts, combining with the secretions already delivered by the seminal vesicle and the ductus deferens for an even more complex mixture, and that gets delivered into the very first part of what is called the urethra. The urethra is a tube that's much longer in males, and it does a slightly different job in males compared to females. It's longer in males than in females because it extends more than all the way through the penis, whereas in females it has a much shorter route. The other difference is that the urethra in males is a delivery device for more than just urine. In females, it's just for urine, but in males, it's for urine and semen. And so there are three major parts to the overall urethra in a male. The first is the prostatic urethra, named for the fact that it is in the prostate. And so all of this rich mixture is still not the complete semen yet. Things have been added by the testes, by the seminal vesicles, and by the prostate, and so it's already a complex mixture, but the semen that is in the prostatic urethra, just about to be ejected during ejaculation, is not complete yet. And that's because there's going to be something added by yet another gland called bulbourethral gland. Bulbo here refers to the bulb of the penis, which is the at the root of the penis, deep part. It's not an externally visible part of the penis, but it's where it begins. There are two of these as well, one on either side. We're looking at the right side right now. But the bulbourethral gland produces mucus, and it gets delivered through this tube to the next part of the urethra. So the next part of the urethra is the membranous urethra, and it's called the membranous urethra. It's the shortest part of the urethra. It's just this part right here. It's called the membranous urethra because it penetrates through this floor of the abdominopelvic cavity, which forms kind of a membrane, so it's called the membranous urethra. And then the third and final part of the urethra overall starts right here, officially inside the penis. And it is called the spongy urethra because as it runs down the length of the penis, it is actually surrounded by spongy-looking material, shown here in cutaway view in blue, which is one of three columns of tissue that are erectile. So there are erectile tissues in the penis, and one of those three is called the corpus spongiosum, which just simply means spongy body. That's what we're looking at in cutaway view right now. Well, the spongy urethra, which is this final and third part of the overall urethra, runs through that corpus spongiosum. And so it is conducting or transporting now the complete semen because the mucus that's been added by the bulbourethral gland gets added as the final component of the semen just before it gets ejaculated out of the penis through the spongy urethra. The other two erectile tissues, by the way, are called corpora cavernosa. The singular of that is corpus cavernosum. That simply means cavernous body. It has more of a appearance as though it's dug out with caverns compared to the spongy urethra. There are two corpora cavernosa and one corpus spongiosum. The three of them are like cylinders that run down the length of the penis, and they get engorged with blood during erection. That's what causes erection. There's a lot more blood that gets delivered to them that is allowed to drain, and therefore hydrostatic pressure from all this engorgement of blood builds up, and that gives the penis its erection. The penis itself is covered by skin, but the head of the penis is properly called the glands. Glans penis is just the anatomical name for the head of the penis. And there is skin covering the glands penis called prepuce. The prepuce, which is a word that means hood, shrouds the glands penis, at least in a male who hasn't been circumcised. If circumcision is performed, then the prepuce gets cut to expose the glands penis. Okay, let's go to slide 2 now. Well, we're seeing a view of the urinary bladder here, which is part of the urinary system, not the reproductive system, but this gives you a good view of what I was saying before. Since we're looking at it kind of from the front and top, you can see that the ductus deferens does not go directly from testis to penis. Instead, it goes from the scrotum up into the abdominal pelvic cavity, loops around the ureter until it ends in the ampulla of the ductus deferens. Then its contribution to the semen gets mixed with the seminal vesicle's contribution to the semen inside the prostate, which also adds its contribution. And then where all of these come together is in the prostatic urethra, the very first part of the urethra. Then it goes through the membranous urethra to get out of the abdominal pelvic cavity and into the penis, where the mucus that's contributed by the bulbo urethral gland gets added so that it's the final version of the semen, and now it's officially in the spongy urethra inside the penis. The penis itself, by the way, you can see here, consists of the so-called root of the penis, which is not visible in an undissected male. That's the deepest part of the penis. And that's the root of the penis. The shaft of the penis is the visible part. The root of the penis, by the way, includes two crura, C-R-U-R-A, which means legs. In fact, crura is the proper plural for the legs that we walk on. Well, those are these parts right here. Those are the crura. And we can also see a good view of all three erectile tissues. This is one corpus cavernosum. This is the other corpus cavernosum. And then in the middle with the spongy urethra running through it is the corpus spongiosum, which also makes up most of the bulk of the gland's penis, or the head of the penis. Now on to slide 3. This is a cutaway view of just one testis and epididymis. And when we look at the interior of a testis, we can see that there are tubules making up the bulk of the interior. Those tubules are called seminiferous tubules. Seminiferous means producing semen. Of course, it doesn't produce the complete semen. It contributes, as far as reproduction is concerned, the most important component of semen, which are the sperm. These seminiferous tubules, which there are many of, are arranged into subsections of each testis called lobules, which means a small lobe. And these lobules are partially separated, not entirely, but partially walled off or separated by septa. Septum is a word that means something that separates chambers, like the septum, the nasal septum separates the right and half, left of the right and left halves of the nasal cavity. So within the seminiferal tubules, sperm will be released, and those eventually make their way to this part, which is called the reti testis. Reti is a word that means a interconnected or network arrangement of something. And so this is the word that reticular is the adjective of. We use the word reticular for a lot of things, but it means occurring as a network, like a reticulated python, for instance, gets its name, or a reticulated giraffe, because the markings on it are all connected to each other, like a reti. Well, the reti testis is a network of tubules that receive those young sperm, immature sperm. They're not viable yet. They need to mature for roughly a couple weeks, and that occurs within each epididymis. And so the epididymis itself is a network of very long tubes. Eventually they all make their way into one tube that is very convoluted, very full of twists and turns, as you see here. And this gives these maturing sperm a long time going through this long tube to mature so that they can eventually be ready for fertilization if they are ejaculated and meet up with an egg. Fertilization, by the way, is the major function of the two reproductive systems, because it takes both sexes for fertilization to occur. Fertilization is the defining moment. That's what actually defines sex. Not all organisms are sexual. We are, and animals are in general, and so are plants. Others are as well, but not all. Asexual organisms don't undergo sexual reproduction. They undergo asexual reproduction, which involves just one parent and creates an identical offspring. In sex, two parents are involved, and they produce offspring that are not identical. They're not identical to each other, and they're also not identical to either parent. So sex produces brand new genetic versions of organisms. And that happens only if fertilization occurs. Fertilization is the fusion of two unicellular gametes, like an egg and a sperm for humans, to produce one unicellular zygote. The zygote is how each of us begins life officially, as one cell. So this is an unusual situation. Usually cells split into two cells, right? But in sex, in fertilization, which is the defining moment of sex, two cells fuse into one cell. And those two cells come from two different parents. So those cells are called gametes, the sex cells. And in human males, those are sperm. And in human females, those are eggs or ova. Well, fertilization is the fusion of a sperm and an egg to produce a zygote. And that zygote is the one cell that is the beginning of the next human, and that one cell will split into many cells until eventually it will be 100 trillion cells or so in the next adult. Now, also in this view in slide 3, we can see what is called the spermatic cord, which includes blood vessels, so both veins and arteries, veins in blue here and arteries in red. But the spermatic cord also includes nerves in yellow. All three of them combined make up the spermatic cord, and there's a spermatic cord for each of the two testes. Oh, the tunica albuginea, by the way, is really just the tough outer covering of each testis. Tunic means coat, and alb means white, like an albino. So tunica albuginea gets its name from the fact that this is a white outer coat. Now on to 4. At the top here, we're looking at a cutaway view of just a few of the seminiferous tubules. So you can see 4 different seminiferal tubules, or it could actually be different parts of the same seminiferous tubule since they loop around so many times. But anyway, each of these round things is part of a seminiferous tubule, and remember that lumen means the hollow interior of a structure. So the lumen of the seminiferous tubule is this inner part. If we look at just this inset in square in close-up, that's what we have below. So this very bottom part, that represents the lumen right here of the seminiferous tubule, and this part represents the wall of the seminiferous tubule, which is made up of many cells, including cells that are called spermatogonia, which is the plural of spermatogonium. Spermatogonia are stem cells, as you see here. They are also called germline cells. There are 2 different kinds of cells making up your body. The vast majority, almost all cells in your body, are known as somatic cells. Somatic just means of the body. And a tiny minority found only in the gonads, whether it's testes in a male or ovaries in a female, that other category of cells besides somatic cells are germline cells. And both germline cells and somatic cells in humans are diploid, D-I-P-L-O-I-D. Now, diploid is a word that refers to it's a degree of ploidy. So P-L-O-I-D-Y is a word general word that refers to how many of each type of chromosome a cell has. Chromosomes are pieces of DNA, and each chromosome contains many genes. This is for any given species. So genes occur on chromosomes, and genes correspond to characteristics. Well, different kinds of cells contain different numbers of each type of chromosome. So first of all, there are different types of chromosomes. And it depends on which species you are as to how many chromosomes you have. We are all humans, and humans have 23 different kinds of chromosomes. Other organisms have more, other species have more, some have fewer. But for humans, that number is 23. And that number is represented by N in any given species. So for humans, N equals 23. That's called the haploid number, H-A-P-L-O-I-D. Haploid means having just one of each type of chromosome. So there are 23 types of chromosomes, and they're different types because each chromosome has a different collection of genes. But if a cell contains just one of each of those 23 types, then it's a haploid cell. A diploid cell, on the other hand, has two of each type. So it has two number ones, two number twos, and so on, all the way through 23. It has two number 23s as well. So it has 2 times 23 overall chromosomes, because it has two of each type. And we represent that as 2N, which is called the diploid number. Well, your somatic cells, which makes up almost all of your body, are all diploid cells. And these germline cells are also diploid. So that's not the difference between a somatic cell and a germline cell. The difference is the type of cell division that these cells can undergo. Somatic cells can undergo only mitosis, which is a part of cell division that creates genetically identical cells that have the same ploidy. So a somatic cell splits by mitosis and cytokinesis to produce 2 new cells, both of which are still diploid, like when your skin cells reproduce to replace the ones that you get that are lost continuously. So that's what happens in somatic cells. Germline cells undergo both mitosis and meiosis, but mitosis happens first. So here you have germline cells in males, and those are called spermatogonia. There are very few of these. So that's why first mitosis is undergone. Mitosis takes one cell, splits it into two. This one cell is splitting into two cells that are genetically identical and have the same ploidy. So this was a diploid germline cell originally. Now we have 2 diploid cells. The reason this is important is because when a cell splits into two cells, the original cell doesn't exist anymore. Therefore, you need to make 2 copies first, one of which will hang around and replace the one that no longer exists. That way you don't run out of germline cells throughout your lifetime. So this one's just going to replace the one that split. The other one is then going to go on and undergo meiosis, which is a totally different kind of cell division. And I don't want to get too bogged down into the details, but the big deal about meiosis is that it does not produce genetically identical cells, because, well, for multiple reasons, but it, one of the things that it does is cut the ploidy in half. So a diploid cell that undergoes meiosis is going to produce haploid cells. And actually there are 2 different divisions, meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, unlike mitosis. So when a cell undergoes complete meiosis, it will end up making 4 cells, and those 4 cells will be haploid, as opposed to the diploid cell that enters the process. Okay, so That's what happens in males. This process is called spermatogenesis, which is a word that means production of sperm cells. Spermiogenesis is a similar word, but that really refers to the maturation of sperm. Meiosis produces the early sperms, which are in immature form called spermatids, and then those spermatids mature within the epididymis. We were talking about that earlier, and that is spermiogenesis. Once they are fully mature, which takes a couple of weeks, then they are ready to be ejaculated through the ductus deferens and various parts of the urethra that we talked about earlier. And they are able then, if they get the chance to, they are able to fuse with eggs released from a female in the process of fertilization. Now on to slide 5. So what we have here is a representation of the human sexual life cycle. And sexual organisms, sexual species in general, undergo a generation to generation. So this is between lifetimes, from one lifetime to the next, from one generation to the next. But there's a generation to generation alternation between two important processes in any given sexual species, including humans. And those two processes are fertilization and meiosis. Now, I already defined fertilization. That is the fusion of two unicellular gametes, egg and sperm, to produce one unicellular zygote. Since these two cells are fusing, that means the zygote that results is going to have the DNA from both of those two gametes. And this is why, this is really what defines sex, right? It mixes up the genetics from the parents. It combines them. So this is why we are diploid organisms, because one of each of the 23 chromosomes is contained in the egg from the female, and one of each of those 23 chromosomes is also contained in the sperm. Now, they are not the same versions of chromosomes, but there are 23 chromosomes in a sperm from human and 23 in the egg. And when they combine, therefore, the zygote is going to now contain 46 overall chromosomes, but there are still only 23 types of chromosomes. It's just that now the zygote has two of each type. It is diploid. So fertilization doubles the ploidy because it combines the chromosomes from the egg and the sperm, both kinds of gametes, into one cell. Now, if that's the only process that we had, then every generation the ploidy would double. And that would get out of hand quickly because there would be no room to hold double the amount of chromosomes every generation. It would quickly mean that the species would go extinct. That's why all sexual species, in addition to fertilization, need this other important mechanism called meiosis. Meiosis is a way to cut the ploidy in half to undo the doubling of the ploidy that occurs in fertilization. And so meiosis occurs in humans in each of the two gonads, in a male's testes and in a female's ovaries. And it takes those diploid spermatogonia in a male and produces haploid sperm. And a similar process is occurring in female ovaries to produce haploid eggs. So that's why sperm and egg are haploid, so that when they combine, they produce only a diploid zygote and not something that has four times tetraploid or eight times octoploid or so on. That would get out of hand quickly. Let's take a closer look at sperm in slide 6. A sperm is an example of a flagellated cell. We humans don't have very many. You find cells with flagella or flagellated cells in a lot of other species, mostly unicellular organisms. Well, the sperm really is a unicellular organism. It's just living in the haploid stage of the human life cycle. We are diploid organisms, we as human individuals. But that really, if we quickly go back to slide 5 to look at the overall life cycle, we, what we call our lifetimes, is really just half of the human life cycle. Not half in terms of time, but half in terms of the two parts. We make up the diploid stage. We as individuals make up the diploid stage. Our gametes make up the haploid stage. And so each egg and each sperm really is an organism by itself, a unicellular organism. But the haploid stage, which includes this, the gametes, does not last very long, because an egg by itself will die. If it's not fertilized, it'll die pretty quickly. A sperm by itself will die pretty quickly. So gametes, either they don't last long for two reasons. Either they die quickly if fertilization doesn't happen, or if fertilization does occur, then they are no longer gametes. Now they are combined into one zygote, which begins the next diploid stage. Let's go back on to slide 6, though, and look at this sperm. It has a long, conspicuous flagellum. That's the whip-like tail, which is exactly what it is. It's a whip that, by moving back and forth, pushes on the liquid environment in which the sperm lives, and that will allow it to propel itself forward. Sperm have to swim quite a long distance in terms of the number of body lengths. If you think about it, a human running, we could define that in terms of adult body lengths. Well, a sperm is much smaller than a body length, but it has its own body length, and how far it swims is many, many, many millions of body lengths. So that's going to require a lot of energy. You can't move for free. And that's why in this mid-piece, right before the tail, there are many mitochondria, which are the organelles responsible for cellular respiration. And that maximizes the production of ATP, which is the energy currency in cells. Well, the ATP provides the energy for all of this vigorous swimming that a sperm has to do if it has any chance of reaching an egg. In the head of the sperm, we have the cell's nucleus. The overall sperm is one cell, but the nucleus of that cell is housed in the head, and the nucleus, of course, contains the DNA. Now, that really is the whole reason this sperm is swimming, so that it has a chance, maybe, of fertilizing an egg, and if that happens, then the chromosomes, which are the DNA pieces within that nucleus, will get delivered to that egg, resulting in fertilization, producing a diploid zygote. Now on to 7. This slide represents something that is called the hypothalamo-pituitary-gonadal axis. That's a complicated word, I know. It's a hyphenated word. It's hypothalamo-pituitary-gonadal axis. And so it includes these three important parts: the hypothalamus, which is part of the brain, the pituitary, and specifically the anterior pituitary, which is part of the brain and part of the, which is part of the nervous system, of course. It's also part of the endocrine system, and the gonads. So we're looking at this in terms of a male first. So the hypothalamo-pituitary-gonadal axis in a male involves the hypothalamus, the anterior pituitary, and specifically the testes as the gonads. They are all linked via information. So there are multiple signals involved here. The hypothalamus releases its own chemical signals, which are called gonadotropin-releasing hormone. Gonadotropin, let's just focus on that word for a second, is a word, trope means act on. So there are different kinds of tropins in the body. A gonadotropin is a chemical or a signal that acts on or has as a target tissue gonads. Well, gonadotropin releasing hormone is not a gonadotropin because it does not have an effect on the gonads. It's called gonadotropin releasing hormone, or GnRH, because it causes the release of gonadotropins. Okay, so GnRH, released by the hypothalamus, travels to the cells in the anterior pituitary, or some of the cells in there, and the effect of that GnRH, gonadotropin releasing hormone, is that it causes anterior pituitary cells to release the actual gonadotropins. That's why GnRH is called gonadotropin releasing hormone. The gonadotropins come in two varieties. They are called follicle stimulating hormone, FSH, and luteinizing hormone, LH. And by the way, these occur, both of these gonadotropins, follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, both occur in both sexes. But and they have the same name in both sexes, but they are named for what they do in a female, actually, which we'll get to after we're through with the male. So they do different things in females than in males, but they have the same names. So there aren't follicles to stimulate in a male, but we still call it follicle-stimulating hormone. Luteinizing hormone is called that because in a female it leads to the production of something that's called a corpus luteum. We'll get to that in a minute. That doesn't happen in a male, but we still call it luteinizing hormone because it is the same chemical. It just acts differently in the two sexes. Okay, so those are the two gonadotropins, FSH and LH. They get released by the anterior pituitary, travel through the bloodstream like all hormones, and then finally reach the gonads, which in males are the testes. And notice what they do. Luteinizing hormones in male stimulates cells within the gonads called interstitial cells. Interstitial means occurring in the spaces between things. Those interstitial cells in the gonads respond to luteinizing hormone by producing testosterone, which is a male hormone. Now, that testosterone controls a lot of things, including sperm production. So that's what we're seeing here with the LH line. The follicle-stimulating hormone, also released at the same time as LH, has a slightly different effect. Follicle-stimulating hormone acts on different cells that are called supporting cells, just as kind of a catch-all phrase. They have a different name that I'm not even going to require you to know because it doesn't matter. But they are supporting cells because these cells support the actual spermatogonia, which are the germline cells that undergo meiosis to produce sperm. So they are both kinds, the germline cells and the supporting cells are both required for proper sperm production, but the supporting cells get their signal from FSH, whereas the germline cells get their signal from luteinizing hormone. And so what we see here is spermatogenesis, and notice that eventually these very young sperm, or spermatids, get released from the wall into the hollow lumen of the seminiferous tubules within the testes. Then they make their way through the reti testis into the tubes that make up the epididymis, and that's where they mature. Now notice the two colors here. Blue refers to a stimulatory pathway. So this is causing increase, whereas the red is inhibiting. That causes a decrease. So this is classic negative feedback, the red part here. Testosterone has, as I said, many functions, one of which is to feed back to this hypothalamo-pituitary-gonadal axis. And so testosterone acts on both the anterior pituitary and the hypothalamus, telling it to turn down its production of these all three of these, the t- Testosterone tells the hypothalamus to turn down production of gonadotropin-releasing hormone, and testosterone tells the anterior pituitary to turn down production of follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. And that's so that you don't release too much at once, right? The testosterone comes from the fact that you've released enough already, and therefore it turns it back down to keep you... That's classic negative feedback. Now on to slide 8. Let's look at a female, and we're looking in slide 8 at a picture that corresponds to the opening slide for males. This is a median section. This doesn't show the complete set of important organs for a female. This is just the pelvic organs of the reproductive system. The primary sex organs, as I already said, in females are the ovaries. The vagina is a secondary sex organ, just like the penis is a secondary sex organ in males. By the way, vagina is a word that means sheath. The sheath is the covering for a sword, and so the vagina is much like the sheath of a sword. It accepts the sword-like penis. But it's a secondary sex organ. It's really just a device for receiving the penis and the sperm that gets ejaculated from the penis. That can lead to fertilization, and so that's an entryway. And it's also a delivery device for the fetus during parturition, assuming pregnancy ensues, and assuming a vaginal birth, that fetus will exit the uterus, which is this item, through the vagina. But the ovaries, one on each side, are the primary sex organs because they produce the gametes. In other words, they are the gonads in a female. And they, as I said, remain in the abdominal pelvic cavity. Closely associated with each ovary is an infundibulum. That's a word that means funnel. And it's kind of shaped like a funnel. This is the wide part of the funnel right here. And it's a fringed funnel. These fringes themselves are fimbriae. A singular of that without the E is fimbria. So each one of these little fringes is a fimbria. They form the large part of the funnel or infundibulum. And they are just associated with part of the ovary. The ovary is where eggs are produced and mature and eventually get ovulated from the ovary. They more or less explode out of the wall of the ovary. And if things go right, they will get caught by this funnel-like infundibulum. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes eggs are just ovulated into the abdominal pelvic cavity, and it's very unlikely that sperm is going to reach them there, so they just die there and get recycled for materials. But often, an ovulated egg reaches the lumen of the infundibulum, which then, once it narrows, becomes the uterine tube. So there's a uterine tube for each, on each side, corresponding to each ovary. The uterine tube then eventually leads to the uterus itself. And the uterus, as we can see in cutaway view, is highly muscular. There are two ends, so to speak, of the uterus. There is a blind end, the dead end here, which is more superior, and that's called the fundus. That's what fundus means, the blind end of something, like the base of an urn, not the open part where you put something into the urn, but the part that it sets on, which is a blind end, is called the fundus of an urn, similarly for the uterus. The uterus is also a hollow organ, but in a non-pregnant uterus, there's nothing in that hollow interior, and it's basically pressed together. It's just moisture. But it's a potential space because it can expand if pregnancy ensues. The opened end of the uterus is a part that comes to a narrowing, and a word that means narrowing or neck is cervix. Like I said in class long ago, the neck, what we call the neck of the body, our normal neck between head and shoulders, is also called the cervix. So the cervix is the neck of the uterus, as a different use of the word. And that's where it opens into the vagina. The vagina itself is highly folded, or kind of has not so much folds as a ring-like appearance inside, which stimulates the penis and makes it more likely for orgasm, which of course is coincident with ejaculation in the male to deliver sperm. Now we also see a view of the opening of the vagina, the external opening of the vagina, which is guarded on either side by two lips. A word that means lip is labium, so the lips on the mouth can be called labia, which is the plural of labium. There are two pairs of lips, though, associated with the female genitalia, and those are called labium minus and labium majus. Those are the singulars. Usually we use the plural, though, because we're talking about both sides. We're looking at just the left labium minus and the left labium majus here, but the plurals are labia minora and labia majora. Now, majus means big and minus means small, so there's one difference. The labia majora are bigger than the labia minora, but also the labia majora are dry, whereas the labia minora are moist epithelium. Also, the labia majora feature hair, whereas the labia minora do not. The labia minora become much bigger when engorged with blood during sexual arousal. And then between the labia minora, just at one end, just at the superior end, if we were looking at this from the front, is the clitoris, which develops the same way that the penis does. We all start out alike, and depending on which hormones we're exposed to, we are similar structures develop differently. Well, what develops into the penis, including the sensitive head or glands of the penis in a male, develops into the clitoris in a female. So this is much shorter than a penis, but has a very similar appearance when you look at the whole thing. Most of this is invisible because it's embedded deep in the woman's body, but the glands of the clitoris is the very sensitive part of the clitoris, just like the glands penis in a male is the very sensitive part of the penis. And so stimulation of the head of the clitoris or the glands of the clitoris can lead to orgasm in a female. The vestibular glands, one on either side, produce secretions that moisten the labia minora during intercourse, making it much easier as lubricant for the erect penis to be inserted into the vagina. Now, there's also a mucus that gets produced that helps in this as well. Okay, now let's look at a close-up of an ovary, one of two, in slide 9. And an ovary is a word that means egg factory, really. An egg can also be called an ovum, O-V-U-M, the plural of which is ova. And an interesting thing about females is that the production of her gametes proceeds quite differently from how it proceeds in males. Males don't produce any gametes until they reach puberty, age 13 or so, whatever, it depends on the individual. So they don't start producing any sperm until sexual maturity, and then they produce millions of sperm every day for basically the rest of their life, so for many decades. And every one of those sperm that they produce, millions per day, are fresh eggs, fresh cells, because they were created, you know, just weeks ago. It takes a couple weeks for them to mature in the epididymis, as I said. On the female, on the other hand, a female starts the production of her eggs before she's even born, when she is still a fetus in her mother's uterus, she has millions of potential eggs that start the process of meiosis and then pause it. And it gets paused for almost two decades until she is not only born, but reaches sexual maturity. Let me go back a little bit. She has millions of potential eggs while she's still a fetus. Most of those die before she's born. She still has thousands left by the time she's at sexual maturity and starts menstruating and ovulating. And instead of making millions of brand new cells each day like a male does, she just produces one normally, one per 28 days roughly, one per ovarian cycle, and releases it. And that's why even though she's lost millions of potential eggs, the thousands that she has is still more than enough that she will need for the three decades or so in which she'll be able to produce viable eggs, because she's producing them at basically one per month for only a few decades. So it's not only that, when she finally ovulates, whatever cell gets chosen to be the one that's matured into an egg that gets ovulated, that is already a very old cell, because it's really older technically than the woman is, because it started out when she was a fetus, whereas the sperm produced by the male are brand new cells. So we're just looking at close-up of some cells that are in various stages of development here. Notice that there are things in ovaries called follicles. Primary follicles develop if they are chosen. There are even earlier things not listed here called primordial follicles. So that's what you have thousands of. And each cycle, each roughly a month, some of those primordial follicles will be randomly chosen to develop into primary follicles, which then develop and get bigger and bigger, as you see. These are growing follicles in different stages of development. And then normally, only one of those growing follicles gets chosen to each cycle to fully mature and produce an egg that gets released during the process of ovulation. And that ovulation event is really just an eruption. So the egg ruptures out of the tough coating exterior to the ovary itself. That egg gets released and into the abdominal pelvic cavity, and usually, as I said, gets caught by that funnel-like infundibulum, which is kind of partially surrounding the ovary. Now, after ovulation, which is the release of the egg from the follicle, then we no longer call this thing a follicle. Once it's released its egg, we call what used to be a follicle a corpus luteum, which means yellow body. Corpus means body, luteum means yellow. As you can see, it has a yellowish body. And so this is why the hormone that's mostly responsible for ovulation is called luteinizing hormone, even in males, as I said. It's called this because in a female, the ovulation that luteinizing hormone causes also causes the formation of the corpus luteum. So it's luteinization, the formation of a corpus luteum. And that corpus luteum will continue to produce its own hormones for a while. If there's no pregnancy, then it will just die out and degenerate, as you see here. if it's pregnancy does occur, then it's called a corpus luteum of pregnancy, and it will stick around for a much longer time producing important hormones until a placenta sufficiently develops between the female and her developing embryo that can take over the hormone jobs of the corpus luteum of pregnancy. Okay, now to 10. So here we can see a cutaway view of that same ovary we're just looking at, partially surrounded by the infundibulum, and you can see that the egg being released during ovulation is going to be caught by these finger-like fimbriae and put into the hollow lumen of the infundibulum that eventually, it's the same tube, but eventually once it narrows a little bit, it's called the uterine tube. And that leads to the lumen of the uterus. So, if sperm are introduced into the vagina at the right time, then they can swim all the way up the vagina through the cervix of the uterus, through the main body of the uterus, up into each of the two uterine tubes, because there are millions of sperm in each ejaculate. So some of those sperm will keep swimming through one uterine tube and some will swim through the other uterine tube. And if ovulation had occurred at just the right time, then there might be an egg somewhere in this uterine tube. And one of those sperm, under correct conditions, will be allowed to fertilize that egg. And so fertilization usually happens, if it's going to happen at all. If there's no egg there, the sperm will just die, and the woman will not get pregnant. But usually fertilization, if it happens, happens in the uterine tube. And that is where the zygote gets created, but that's not where you want that zygote to start splitting into multiple cells to produce an embryo. You don't want the embryo to develop here. So the zygote moves down into the uterus and implants into the endometrium, which is the inner lining of the uterus. And that's where it splits into two cells, then four, and then eight, and so on. Becomes an embryo first, and then a fetus eventually, and then it will be born through the vagina and become a baby. Now back to the endometrium. It is just one of three layers in the overall wall of the uterus. So there's a thin inner layer, which is, I shouldn't say thin because it's sometimes thin, it's sometimes thick. It undergoes a drastic range of thicknesses, but that inner lining is called endometrium. It's thinner, though, in all cases, than the bulk of the wall of the uterus, which is myometrium. Now, endo means inside, myo means muscle, like myofibers we were talking about earlier. The myometrium is made up of smooth muscle making up most of the wall of the uterus. It's a muscular organ because it needs to contract in order to expel the fetus during parturition or childbirth. And then the outer covering is perimetrium. Peri means around, remember? So those three together make up the overall wall of the uterus. There are also important ligaments, which are connective tissue membranes, keeping all of these structures in place. So there's a broad ligament, broad not meaning a female, broad. It's broad because it's wide. And it is a passageway also for important vessels and nerves. And then there's also a round ligament and an ovarian ligament keeping things in place as well. Let's go on to 11 and look at a close-up view of the perineal region in a female. Perineal is just the adjective of perineum. So the perineum is this area outlined by the dashed line. And it's really formed, these four corners are formed by bony landmarks. So the coccyx bone here, the bones of the pelvis right here, and where the two pubes come together, which is the pubic symphysis, which is also a pelvic structure right here. Those four corners make up the so-called perineal region, but in terms of surface anatomy, the perineum is mostly referred to as the region between, you know, on a female, the region between the vagina and the anus. In a male, it would be between the scrotum and the anus. So we can see the vaginal orifice right here, surrounded by the two sets of labia that we already talked about, the labia minora, which are moist and smaller than the dry and hairy and larger labia majora. And so the labia minora are usually not entirely exposed, like we see here. To do that, you have to move the labia majora out of the way. We get a good view of the placement of the clitoris, which, remember, is analogous to the... I shouldn't say analogous, actually, it's homologous. It corresponds to the head of the penis in a male, and just like the head of the penis, the glans penis, is covered by a prepuce, a hood-like skin covering, that's also true for the clitoris. The prepuce of the clitoris covers the clitoris itself. Slide 12 is a close-up view of the eruption of an egg, or oocyte. Oo just means egg. Cyte means cell. So an egg cell is being released from a follicle in the ovary. This is the surface of the ovary. You can see that it just explodes out of the outer surface. Now, slide 13 illustrates the development of an egg from a primordial follicle originally within a female's ovary. And notice that some of this happens before she is even born. This is what I was talking about earlier. So primordial follicles develop into primary follicles that go partially through the maturation stage, and then they kind of pause. Most of them will die, but some of them will pause and still be alive until not only is she born, but goes through childhood, but then eventually she is in her sexual maturity. And some of them will pause until she's in her 40s, because they might be the last ones to be released. So that's why it says monthly from puberty to menopause. Menopause is when she will stop menstruating and stop ovulating. But that's when the process of meiosis and the rest of maturation is finalized. And usually this happens in just one ovary. This is another interesting thing about females. Not only does she produce usually just one viable gamete per cycle, but she does so in only one of her two ovaries. Usually it's in a ping-pong fashion. So one ovary will release an egg in 1 month, and then in the next month, the other ovary will release one. Another difference is that, remember I said that meiosis, since it involves two different cell divisions, it produces four cells from the one that you start with. And in a male, all four of those become viable sperm. Viable means that they're fully able to live, able to do their job. So each spermatogonium that undergoes meiosis will produce four sperm, all equally viable. In a female, on the other hand, four things are produced, but three of them, known as polar bodies, are tiny compared to the fourth one, and they just get thrown away. And that's because the fourth one needs to save as much cytoplasm from the original cell as possible. This, by the way, is how we define females and males. It's obvious in us. Sometimes it's not obvious in a species that you look at which is the male and which is the female. Well, the female is the sex that produces the bigger of the two gametes. An egg is much bigger than a sperm. And that's because the sperm is really only going to deliver its tiny DNA chromosomes into the egg. And when that results in a zygote, the zygote really isn't any bigger than the egg. It just has the extra DNA from the sperm added in. It needs as much to be as big as possible for it to have a chance of survival. And that's why the female doesn't make four small eggs. It makes one big egg, and the other three things are just thrown away. Slide 14. Now we're going to look at a few slides in succession that illustrate two important cycles that are happening at the same time in women, and those are called the ovarian cycle and the uterine cycle. Ovarian obviously meaning having to do with the ovaries, and uterine having to do with the uterus. But they are happening at the same time, just different things are happening to different structures. What we have in this graph, though, is a trace for showing you the level of these two important hormones in the female's bloodstream. So there's low levels of both luteinizing hormone and follicle-stimulating hormone until right here where you have a surge in both of these. But notice that there's a much greater surge in luteinizing hormone than there is in follicle-stimulating hormone. There's a surge in both, but it's the luteinizing hormone, or LH surge, is much more important. And we'll see that is actually what brings about ovulation. So let's go on to the next slide in 15 to correlate this in time. What we're looking at here is the ovarian cycle, just one of the two important cycles. This is what's happening in the ovules, in the ovaries. There are two major phases to the ovarian cycle, the so-called follicular phase, named for the fact that that's when follicles are developing, and then the so-called luteal phase, which is having to do with the corpus luteum. Well, remember I said that the corpus luteum is really just a follicle that gets renamed. We don't call them follicles after the follicle releases its egg. So that's the defining event. Ovulation, release of the egg, is the official end of the follicular phase, and it's the official beginning of the luteal phase. And when this happens is variable not only between women, but period to period within females, it's variable. So this day 14, that is really just an average. Each woman acts a little bit differently. But that ovulation event is really caused by that huge LH surge that we saw right here in slide 14. Now, let's go to slide 16 and look at two other hormones, estrogens and progesterone. By the way, these have interesting names. The gen part means create, like in Genesis or generation. The estro part refers to estrus, which means wild desire. It's what we call heat in pets, like a dog is in heat. It has mad desire or wild desire. That's really what that word comes from. So estrogen gets its name because it causes wild desire, supposedly. And progesterone gets its name because it promotes gestation, which is pregnancy. So we can see here fluctuation of these two important hormones in females. The estrogens get released by follicles. And so as follicles develop during this follicular phase, more and more estrogens get released because the follicles are getting bigger and bigger. And that explains why there's more estrogen. And the higher estrogen gets, the more luteinizing hormone gets released. And so this is why you have this LH surge, because of a gradual increase in estrogen. Now, progesterone remains low during this time. Here between blue and green, we have ovulation occurring. So now the green part here refers to the luteal phase. And the egg has been released because this is post-ovulation. If that egg gets fertilized by a sperm, then you're going to have a corpus luteum of pregnancy. If not, then the woman will not get pregnant, of course. Well, progesterone, as I said, is named for the fact that it promotes gestation, and it does that. It makes conditions good for pregnancy by acting on the uterus and specifically keeping the endometrial lining of the uterus very thick and moist and just right for a developing embryo. And so the progesterone level gets high after ovulation to prepare the uterus for what might be a fertilized egg or zygote that is going to implant as an embryo in the uterus. If that doesn't happen, though, then the corpus luteum will stop producing progesterone and it will drastically dip. And that in that decrease in progesterone is then going to lead to menstruation, which is the beginning of the next cycle. If it's pregnancy, on the other hand, then the progesterone level will remain high because that corpus luteum of pregnancy will continue to secrete it until the progesterone and estrogen levels are taken over by the placenta. There's no placenta that occurs without pregnancy. Okay, now we're in slide 17. We're looking at the same sequence of time, but these illustrate the uterine cycle, not the ovarian cycle. It's happening at the same time as the ovarian cycle, but here's what's happening to the lining of the uterus. By the way, we define day one as the first appearance of menstrual blood, menstrual flow. The menses is just another name for menstrual flow. That's when blood gets released, blood and other material gets released from the vagina. When that first occurs, we define that as day one of both of these cycles. And so in the graph, we have the lining of the endometrium. And it was a little bit thicker. It's getting thinner and thinner because that's what menstrual flow is. It's the degeneration of that thicker endometrial lining, and that stuff is shed. So that usually lasts, on average, about 5 days. And then, to prepare for the possibility in the next cycle of pregnancy, the endometrium will grow fresh and thicken again. This happens during the proliferative phase. So there's three subphases of the uterine cycle. The menstrual phase, which is the shedding of the previous endometrium. The proliferative phase. Proliferative means increasing in number. And that's because the cells that make up the endometrium get stimulated into dividing into new cells. This adds many, many more cells. The cells are proliferating. So this is why it's getting thicker. And then the secretory phase is the third phase of the uterine cycle, because once the enough cells develop, they will start secreting substances through these endometrial glands to make the lining moist and with just the right chemistry for an embryo, should it occur, or zygote first and then an embryo, should it occur, this would be just the right conditions for it. But if that doesn't occur, and this is maintained, this thickness is maintained by progesterone, if that progesterone level falls, which it will if no pregnancy occurs, then that decrease in progesterone is what signals the uterus to undo all of this preparation and degrade this endometrial lining for the beginning of another menses in the next cycle. Okay, now on to 18. The important components of the female reproductive organ system that we haven't really talked about yet are the mammae. M-A-M-M-A-E is the plural of mamma, M-A-M-M-A, or the breasts. Mammae is plural, though. And notice that this is why we are called mammals. Mammals have mammae, which are organs that include mammary glands. Now, breast and mammary gland are not the same thing. The mammary glands are just parts of the breasts. But anyway, the mammary glands are parts of the breasts that secrete milk. And so true milk is produced only by mammals. Well, the brownish parts of this figure represent the parts of the breasts that are responsible for producing milk. And the production of milk is called lactation. Lact means of milk. That's why lactic acid gets its name. It's acid that's in milk. But lactation is production of milk, and that occurs in mammary glands, which are made up of lactiferous ducts. Or I shouldn't say the glands are. The glands themselves are arranged in little sac-like structures called alveoli, same word that we use for the sac-like structures in the lungs. And so they are arranged in lobules. Those make up the mammary glands. They're busy producing milk. Once that milk is secreted, it gets delivered into lactiferous ducts, which means milk-carrying ducts. And then they widen into what are called lactiferous sinuses. Sinuses are widened parts of things. So there's several different lactiferous sinuses corresponding to several different lactiferous ducts. And then they all come together at the nipple. So the nipple has the openings to these lactiferous sinuses, and therefore milk can be ejected through the nipple. So there's really two parts, two different functions. There's lactation, which is the production of milk, and that occurs in women who are pregnant or nursing, and it occurs more or less continuously. And so milk gets stored in these lobules and then can eventually be ejected through this ductwork through the nipples. And that's the second major function. Lactation is really just production of the milk. A separate function is ejection of the milk through the nipple in response to suckling of the nipples by the infant. Or you could use a suction pump to do the same thing. But that's a different process, and there's two different hormones involved. There's one hormone responsible for stimulating the glands into producing the milk, and there's a different hormone that's responsible for ejecting the milk out of the nipples. Each nipple, by the way, is a rounded mound of tissue surrounded by a darkened circle called the areola. Areola means ring. It's a dark ring. And likely the areoli are really just targets. They're highly visible targets for the infant to make sure he or she is suckling on the right part of the breast in order to get milk from it. Now, a lot of the bulk of the breast is made up of adipose tissue or fat. So in a non-pregnant and non-nursing female, the size of the breast is almost entirely due to the fat tissue, the adipose tissue that's in there. Because in a non-pregnant, non-nursing female, the mammary glands are very small. They're not producing milk. But this is why, regardless of the breast size in a given woman, when she's not pregnant or nursing, the breast will get even bigger when she's pregnant and remain bigger while she's nursing. We see another view of the mamma on slide 19. This is a cutaway view, a median section of just this mamma, or I should say a sagittal section, since it's not really on the midline of the body, it's just on the midline of the breast itself. Anyway, there's really no new information shown here, except you see a good view of the intercostal muscles occurring between the ribs. Well, all of the bulk of the breast is superficial to that, including the adipose tissue and the tissue that makes up the glands themselves. Now to 20. This is a timeline of development for a human. Fertilization, if it occurs, is simply that fusion of the two gametes, the egg and the sperm. They combine their DNA. So the sperm is contributing a haploid set of chromosomes, because there's one of each of the 23 kinds of chromosomes from that sperm, from that father. And that gets added to one of each of the 23 chromosomes that the egg already had from the female to produce a one-celled zygote that now is diploid. The sperm and the egg each were haploid. The zygote is diploid, or 2N. And that is the beginning of you when you were conceived. And like I said, that usually occurs in the uterine tube. But then that zygote will be moved to the ovary and implanted into the ovary and start to become multicellular. We technically only call the zygote a zygote when it's one cell. When it splits into two cells, that's the very earliest embryo, which we call a conceptus, because conception is the another name for fertilization. So the conceptus is the very earlier embryo, and then it becomes more and more multicellular as more mitosis occurs to produce more and more cells. So we see it as a three-week embryo here. We continue to call it an embryo, which looks just like a mass of cells originally, which is all it is, until it eventually kind of starts looking like a human. But then eventually, at 12 weeks, we start calling it a fetus, and it looks much more like a human than the embryo does. This is just a different stage of development, though. And it will continue to be a fetus until it gets born, which is roughly 9 months after fertilization. Slide 21. Here's a good view of what I was talking about earlier when I said that most pregnancy, or most fertilization, occurs in the uterine tube. So you have ovulation from the ovary, the egg or oocyte gets released into the, or I mean gets collected by the funnel-like infundibulum. Now a sperm has to come, assuming that sperm has been delivered by a penis through intercourse into the vagina, that sperm has to swim those millions of body lengths through the vagina, through the cervix of the uterus, through the body of the uterus, through the uterine tube. Same thing's happening on the other uterine tube. Until it, and millions of sperm will be making this trip. And that's why you see many sperm here trying to fertilize this egg, but only one of them can be allowed to. So they're all basically knocking on the door. One of them, if successful, will fertilize the egg, and that will prevent all the others from doing the same. They'll be locked out. And that is the official beginning of pregnancy, which happens a lot more often than females are aware. Females undergo pregnancy without even realizing it, because many pregnancies are spontaneously aborted. Something goes wrong and it just doesn't develop. But it usually occurs here in the uterine tube. That's the zygote. And then the very early embryo gets moved to the uterus itself and embedded into the endometrium, where it becomes bigger and bigger as more cells are added. So it goes from zygote to four-celled stage, to morula, to early blastocyst, and then to a blastocyst, once it's implanted, then it's going to become bigger and bigger as a more mature embryo, and then finally a fetus. And by the way, between that embryo and eventually fetus, between that new organism, that new individual, and the uterus, which is obviously part of the mother, there grows a placenta, which isn't shown here. But the placenta is interesting because it's really an organ that is partly owned by the mother and partly owned by the fetus, embryo and fetus. 22 shows you the steps of parturition, or childbirth. And this is something I've talked about several times before, because I've used it as a good example of positive feedback, which is much rarer than negative feedback. So I've explained it before, but now we finally have a picture. When it comes time for parturition or childbirth, the fetus, which is usually arranged with head pointing downward, that head start stretching on the cervix of the uterus, which is the narrow part. So it becomes wider, stretching it, and that gets sensed by presso receptors, which are stretch receptors in the cervix. That sends information to the brain, specifically the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus releases oxytocin, or I'm sorry, the hypothalamus sends a signal to the posterior pituitary to release oxytocin. Oxytocin is an endocrine signal. It's a hormone that gets released into the bloodstream, travels via the blood back to the uterus, and the uterus has the receptors for oxytocin. Remember that a hormone has to have the right kind of receptors for it to respond. The oxytocin tells the uterus, and specifically the fundus part up here, the blind-ended part where the feet are of the fetus, to contract. When that contraction occurs, that squeezes the fetus farther down toward the vagina, which means the head is now going to stretch that cervix even more. And that sends an even greater signal to the brain, which responds by telling the posterior pituitary to release even more oxytocin, which makes it squeeze even harder, and that's why it's positive feedback. It keeps building until, if everything goes right, the fetus will pop out through the vagina. I know it's probably not as easy as I'm making it sound, but if the fetus pops out, then the positive feedback mechanism is done with, and normal negative feedback will restore homeostasis in the mother, in the brand new mother. And I think that is the chapter. Yes, it is.